The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For today is equanimity. It's one of the most significant practices of Buddhism, to practice equanimity. Even more important, it's one of the most significant states of mind or emotions almost that are cultivated and developed through practice. It's considered to be one of the crown jewels of mental states that get developed in Buddhism. And for some people, it's quite a surprise as practice develops how strong and powerful the feeling, the quality of equanimity can be. For people who haven't really sensed the value of it, it might seem very close to indifference or seem kind of dull. Why would anybody want to be equanimous? But in fact, it's quite a very beautiful and very meaningful state and quality and practice to do. And it's something I think that's extremely significant and valuable for people in their ordinary daily lives. There's lots of opportunities, situations where equanimity is really a valuable way of meeting what's the challenges of life. people... Seems like lately I've been meeting, talking to a lot of people who have a lot of family challenges. Usually it's family difficulties, that a lot of tensions and anger in the family, or particular family members, close ones even, for whom there's quite an estrangement or difficulty. And having equanimity in those relationships can be crucial to make them go forward or in a healthy way. People have challenges with work or not having work. And so being equanimous about finances or work, co-workers who are difficult, the bosses that are difficult. People have challenges with their health. People can get, suddenly sometimes big announcements from the doctor about news they'd rather not have, or have health challenges. And so equanimity comes into play there. And, and over again, in the kind of variety of crises that people can face in their lives, equanimity can be a very useful and significant practice. But learning how to be equanimous, how to practice it, and how to tap into this quality is one of the functions of practice. And the angle I wanted to take in discussing it is to talk about how equanimity is cultivated, developed in meditation practice. And because meditation is kind of a laboratory, or people call it the gym, a laboratory for experimenting, developing, exploring, cultivating a variety of different inner quality states of minds, cultivating skills, that we learn these skills in meditation, and those skills and insights then are applicable to our life outside. And sometimes we could solidify or develop these skills and insights in meditation so they're strong enough to serve us in our daily life. For me to tell people, oh, you should be equanimous, you have some major tragedy in your life, oh, just go be equanimous. And that's all you need to do. That doesn't really help them much if they haven't actually explored themselves, developed themselves. And meditation practice is one of those places where that laboratory, that experimentation, that trial and error, that development happens. It gives you something in meditation that you can carry with you into daily life. So how is equanimity practiced and developed in meditation practice? In infinite number of ways, and I'll go through a series of them, with the hope that as you listen to this, perhaps that you can imagine in your mind similar situations outside of meditation where the same thing would apply, would be valuable. So one of the places is that sooner or later, meditation is uncomfortable. And we don't usually advertise that. The public press is meditation is stress reducing and produces calm and it's bliss and things like that. And that's certainly part of meditation practice. That can be part of it and part of the value. But at least the kind of meditation we do, a very important part of it is meeting your life as it is, and learning how to meet it as it is, not how you want it to be. And so there are certainly times meditation is uncomfortable. a really great kind of discomfort that can arise that's really can teach you a lot is the itch. You have an itch someplace. And as far as I know, no one has died in meditation from an itch. And in fact, I don't think it's really harmed anybody to have an itch during meditation. But it can be very compelling, the strong urge to scratch it or do something with it. But knowing that it's safe to have an itch gives you an opportunity to kind of not act on the desire to scratch. And that maybe goes against how life is usually lived. If you live outside, in normal life, you have an itch, you scratch. It's not a big deal. No one notices. You know, it's not really nothing, not even thought about. It's done almost unconsciously. But here, in meditation, if meditation involves a commitment within reason to sit still and not move, then you're there staying with the itch. And it takes a lot, sometimes a tremendous amount, to not give in to that urge to scratch. Or not give in to the urge to assign meaning to it, tell a story about it. The mind, oh, you know, I have this itch, and probably I need to go to the doctor. And then the agitation begins, you know, what it all means. And so how to stay patient, how to stay non-reactive around the itch is a challenge. And so you might have to develop a lot of inner strength, not to give in to this strong compulsion. So then that cultivates the ability to be non-reactive. And the stronger the itch, the more it requires of us. We have to be very attentive to the power of the mind, how quickly it operates, how quickly it can translate into movement in the hand. We have to learn our relationship to discomfort. We have to see, in our judgments, and there might be judgments about, oh, I guess I'm a meditation failure. I came here for bliss, and I got an itch. And if I was really doing this right, I would be sitting here surrounded by white light, and there would be, you know, certainly no itch. Itch is going on. But in a realistic life where we have challenges all the time, you might actually benefit a lot more from confronting that itch and working through that and not having a comfortable meditation than you are sitting there in some kind of blissful, calm state. Because how often are you going to sit in a blissful, calm state in daily life? In daily life, you can be challenged all the time with uncomfortable situations, and to learn the inner terrain, your reactivity, your beliefs, your feelings, your emotions, to have cultivated some inner strength not to give into it will serve you really well out there. So it's not just itches. It could also be other discomforts when you sit. It might be pain. And pain is a very good teacher because it's much more complex than an itch. Many more things get activated inside of us. Emotions, beliefs, a sense of self, all kinds of things. And so what does it mean not to get swept away, swept into the world of reactivity and world of ideas and thoughts and feelings around the pain? One of the things I've learned early on in my meditation was how my reaction to the pain made the pain worse. And so learning not to react to the pain, and one of the first things I learned was the role of self-pity. And I could see, it was very clear that when I started having thoughts of self-pity, the pain would get worse. If I just stopped thinking of poor Gil, the pain would get slightly better. And slightly better was better than worse. And so I got to see, look at that. There's this reactivity that's, for me, self-pity. Let me not give in to those thoughts. Let me not act on those thoughts or can participate in those thoughts. Let me let go of them. And so I learned to let go of certain kinds of thinking. Those thinking themselves made the situation worse. So here I was also then learning how to let go. Let go of beliefs, stories, ideas that weren't serving me in the situation. And those also help with equanimity because you come into all kinds of situations in daily life that are tragic, difficult, and the mind can create a tremendous amount of stories about what this means, where this is going, some of those stories are not going to be true. And the capacity to see how the mind conjures up stories, interpretations, meanings around things, and learning how to let go of it over and over again is very helpful. And the muscle, that ability to let go of thinking that way, is very, very helpful. I find it, you know, still to this day, that if I have some interpersonal difficulty with someone, if I'm not in the room with them, if, you know, they're someplace else, I'm not seeing them, my mind tends to kind of live a little bit more of a story about what this means and who they are and all kinds of whatever. And I've learned that if I have, I feel any tension with someone, I should get myself in the room with them, meet them personally, because then that breaks through some of the little story things that my mind tends to make. And so it's easier to let go. But in meditation, you can see how this operates and start developing this capacity to let go of all these extra things and thoughts. There also can be pleasant meditations. There can be blissful meditations. Wow, this is great. I don't need any equanimity. I'm sitting in the pinnacle of equanimity. This is like perfect. Nothing's ever going to bother me again. Whenever. And then 5 minutes later, we have to make an announcement that I'm sitting in the middle of meditation. My meditation, my bliss. I had it, I had it, and now I don't have it, and this is really difficult, and what was going on, and I'm upset, and this and that. And then eventually a person notices, wait a minute, I'm really reacting. I guess I was really attached to my pleasant state. I had assigned meaning to that. I finally made it. They'll probably give me a badge here at IMC, medal. And now they're not going to give me the medal or whatever. I've seen, partly through a lot of experience, how the attachment to pleasant states in meditation leads to suffering. I try to reconstruct it the next sitting. I try to hold on to it. I try to protect it from not going away. I try to resist other people's requests of me or demands of me. And what I've learned is that it's actually best for me, for my well-being and health, and sometimes for the health and well-being of others, when pleasant things happen in meditation, that I don't cling to it, that I don't assign meaning to it, I just leave it alone. I don't hold on to it in any way, just let it be. And that equanimity, that balance, has come for me partly out of being burnt repeatedly. And that's part of where wisdom comes from. And in meditation, hopefully you get burnt in really small ways. And so you say, oh, that didn't work, to hold on to that. So even a pleasant experience in meditation can help teach us equanimity. And then there's equanimity around emotions. You can have strong emotions can arise in meditation. And it can be really obvious that all the reactive ways of being with it are detrimental, are harmful, or cause stress and strain and exhaustion. So there can be despair arise in meditation. And it was exhausting to resist it, to hold it down. No, please, no, don't have that. I can't have that. And finally, letting go of that resistance and having the tears just wash through me really freely, because I just couldn't sustain the resistance. And to realize that there was no problem with having tears flow, to have the emotions flow. And actually there's a kind of freedom, beautiful freedom and purity, to let our emotional life flow through us freely, without resisting or holding on or acting on it, getting involved in it, but kind of being a kind of clear channel for whatever emotion it might be. It could be anger, it could be fear, it could be sadness, it could be happiness, it could be joy, it could be many things that come through. And so in meditation, slowly over time, we start seeing when different emotions come through, what our relationship to it, how we complicate it, and how we can become a clean channel for it. And that clean channel becomes equanimous in the sense that we're not reacting to it. And that can serve us in daily life a lot, because sooner or later you'll have an emotion in daily life. We'll have maybe some very strong situation, maybe a boss at work does something that makes you extremely angry, or a coworker, or you feel filled with fear around something that's happened with your health, or health of a friend of yours or something. And how do you relate to it? If you're not wise about your strong emotions are going to fuel it, reactive tendencies, all kinds of reactive tendencies. Perhaps you'll say things you regret later, or perhaps you'll run away, and weren't present for the situation. But if you've learned how to be open to the emotions and how to be non-reactive to it, let it move through you freely, it's a lot easier than to stay present for the situation with equanimity, because the emotion doesn't have the upper hand. It's not going to push you around. And so meditation is one of those places where we kind of emotions happen and we learn to be with them and learn how to be with them in an open, relaxed way. Just let them move through. Even if they're quite intense, it can be very valuable to do that. Then there's all kinds of sitting and meditation. Sooner or later, you'll notice that you're thinking. And you'll notice the role that thinking has. Not only that you're thinking, but you might start noticing some of the themes. You might notice that you have a very strong tendency to measure everything that's going on to your sense of self. You're sitting there meditating, and maybe you start thinking a lot, maybe I'm not wearing the right clothes. To be a really cool Buddhist that I see, maybe there's a particular uniform, that kind of way people close. So you kind of open your eyes a little bit and look around. I wonder what the right clothes is here. I bet if I came to work here, in a suit and tie and a white shirt, I suspect that within a year, we'd find a lot of guys coming to IMC and starting kind of dressing up more. And, it wouldn't take much, I bet. Just because it's very subtle. It's maybe not even conscious, But you see, sometimes you can see very clearly those thoughts coming in on self. Or, I'm not sitting straight enough. Or, I didn't get concentrated enough in that sitting. I bet the person next to me is concentrated. And so you can maybe start seeing how there's this referencing back to self and self-image going on, and how it takes you away from the present moment, being really present and mindful. And so you can see, oh, this sense of self, this story around self is operating even here in meditation. Wow, I only managed to get to 3 breaths. I must be a meditation klutz. And or whatever it might be. And so it can see the suffering that's involved in that kind of thinking. But more important, see how that kind of thinking is simply not necessary. It doesn't serve any purpose. In this kind of context, you can just sit and be present with the kind of simplicity of being with what is. It doesn't have to be interpreted around some idea of self or being someone in particular. This is a very difficult thing to see, because the operating around self-image, how we want to represent ourselves to ourselves or to other people, how we don't want to be in the eyes of ourselves or other people, operates very, very deeply in people's consciousness and psyche. And so, but meditation, in the stillness of meditation, and the repetition of meditation, we do it over and over and over again, we start slowly dawning on us how our sense of self is operating in this context. And we can learn to begin to loosen up around it, perhaps let go of it. To learn that in meditation, around something as simple, meditation, might be very helpful outside of meditation, where a sense of self is operating there as well. And so there might be situations you come into, maybe at first it's very mild situations, unthreatening situations, where you see, oh, I don't have to be anybody here. I don't have to prove myself to this person. I don't have to be apologetic. I don't have to defend myself in this situation. All I'm doing is I'm at the checkout counter, and, I don't have to explain why I'm buying grape juice. I don't have to prove to the clerk, why, whatever. I remember once when I was at I was a town tripper from the monastery, and at the Tassajara I had to go into Monterey to go shopping. And I was a kind of a Zen monk by then. I had a shaved head, and I was very thin back then. I was like 135 pounds tall, thin, shaved head. And I went to town in the truck. I had to buy all this stuff. And wherever they sent me, I had to go buy whatever they needed. And so one of the trips was into Safeway. And I had to buy supplies for a monastery of about 50, 60 people. But the only thing they needed from Safeway was, I don't know why, but they wanted, I don't know how many, but lots and lots of boxes of matzah bread, those crackers, right? And lots of gallon containers of jam. So here I am. Thin, tall, shaved head. All I eat, all I buy is matzo crackers and jam. So that raised some eyebrows around me. So do I have to explain myself? Do I have to say, by the way, it's not for me? And what does it matter what they think of me? Let them think whatever they want. I mean, why should I care what these people, it's not, doesn't really, even if they think the worst of me, so what? So that's a mild situation, let go of trying to show, try to explain to them it's different than what they think. It doesn't matter, right? So what I'm trying to say, meditation is a place where you might start seeing how these things operate. It might be around meditation itself, but chances are it's about a lot of other things. Sooner or later, you start seeing how that sense of self operates and how so much of it is not necessary. Not only is it not necessary, but sometimes causes undue suffering. And so we learn to let go. This helps a lot with equanimity because so much of the reactivity we have can be around sense of self. Then there's the idea, the role, the other places that the mind does. Mind can interpret things, make stories, project into the future, all kinds of fantasies. And meditation, you can start seeing this working as well, sometimes very acutely. And the more acutely you can see it, you can start getting wise about this functioning of the mind that's always, making stories. And start start doubting those stories, not automatically believing them. And this can be very helpful because who knows what the future brings. And some of the reactivity we have in daily life, where we're not equanimous, not balanced or centered, is we're reacting to the fantasy, the projection we have about what's going to happen in the future. And sometimes the projections are accurate, for sure. But I don't know about you, but my success rate in projecting the future has been abysmal. And it's, things seldom turn out the way that I expect them to turn out. Certainly not down to the detail in which I'm capable of anticipating how this is going to turn, it's supposed to be. So then to hold certainly there's appropriate to project into the future, to think about the future and plan for it, but to hold that lightly has been one of the ways of helping us be equanimous. And then in meditation, as we kind of do this practice more and more, there are other things that support equanimity in meditation practice. One of them is beginning to become curious about what's going on here. And curiosity is a very different mode of being in the world, interest, than being interested in self-pity, being interested in what we're afraid about in the future, being interested in all the wrongs that people have done me, being interested in the strong aversion I have towards my anger. So interested where you get lost in the world of aversion. All these reactions can happen. But if we're most interested in our interest, what's really happening here? To be curious, to investigate, changes the whole ecosystem, changes the whole dynamic. And just to be interested rather than reactive, to be more interested than you are reactive, tends to diminish the reactivity, offers something different a different way of being that tends to support equanimity, more balance, or being centered, even-minded. And so at some point, as people do mindfulness practice, at some point the value of investigation, the value of looking more deeply, being interested in experience rather than reactive to it, becomes highlighted. And so that Another thing that can create equanimity in meditation, because in meditation, all kinds of challenges can happen as well. It's not, again, because meditation is just kind of a microcosm, sometimes an intensified microcosm, of life as it usually is. So there can be quite difficult challenges that happen in meditation as well. And one of the things that can bring equanimity is through experience of having done a lot of practice, to develop confidence that the practice works. To develop confidence that being mindful, letting go, being concentrated, keeping up, keeping on, just staying, keeping the course with the practice, that things work out for the better, things work out. And that the mindfulness supports us is valuable. And to develop confidence in that, and to have that confidence under your belt, in a sense, then it's a lot easier to not be reactive to the difficulties that come up as they occur. Difficulties will occur, but you say, oh, I have the practice. Isn't this great? I have something that I can meet this with. I have a tool. I have something I have faith in, some value in. It can be very helpful. Another thing that develops equanimity is as practice continues and we start becoming less reactive to our experience, we start also then becoming calmer, more relaxed about things, more ease, more sense of peace happens. And at some point, that calm or that ease or that peace can be seen as being valuable. Not something to cling to, but something that has some sense of integrity or purity or satisfaction or beauty or meaning for ourselves. And it has more meaning, more satisfaction, more value than our neurosis. Imagine that. More valuable than our, you know, being involved in our fear, or more valuable than clinging to some plan we have for the future or some desire that we have. And so we start, oh, that my desire, you know, might be a very powerful desire, is not, you know, not as valuable as being peaceful. That sense of the greater value and peace can also come from seeing very clearly that strong desire, strong aversion towards something is uncomfortable. To feel that is not satisfying. Meditation is one of the great places to see the dissatisfaction that's inherent in strong desire, strong aversion. And to have a sense that there's some kind of peace, calm, that's more valuable, more meaningful. Then, when you go into your life with some of that calm, and you find yourself beginning to get reactive, it's not just letting go of the reactivity because the reactivity is, you know, doesn't serve you. It's letting go of the reactivity to drop back into something that's more meaningful, more valuable, the calm and the peace. So meditation can give you a place, give you a sense or a state that becomes a different reference point for where you want to live, how you want to be. And so you can fall back into something that's nourishing, some place of you know, calm or stability. And that can make you much more equanimous. Your boss is yelling at you. What's more valuable? Where do you want to reside? Where do you want to live? Do you want to live in the fear? Do you want to live in the anger you have in return? Or is it not worth losing your calm for that state? Can you stay equanimous? Because that's closer. It's closer in. It's more in touch with some depth that we've discovered, something that feels more integral to who we are. The reactivity, the anger we might have, the fear we might have, the running away we might have, feels like more like it belongs to the surface of who we are. Not really deep down inside, something that feels much more integral to our heart or to our, who we are. And so then maybe we're more willing to be there with a boss and stay balanced or stay calm. And that, chances are, will give you a much better opportunity to know what the wise recourse is, what needs to happen, what's best to happen, than it is to yell back or to run away or whatever it might be. Many people have found that by being equanimous, staying calm in difficult situations, they take care of the situation much better than if they're not calm, not reactive. That's a very hard lesson to learn for some people, because sometimes the angry response, the violent response, sometimes has a much more immediate impact. And sometimes if you're violent enough with your voice or whatever, people will shut up. Take care of that. Thank you. But it's not a very effective way. You yell at your boss really loudly and the boss shuts up, is afraid of you. That's nice. Took care of that problem. Until a week later you get your pink slip. I guess it wasn't so useful after all. And there can be very strong beliefs that our people have about the value of strong antagonistic kind of responses. But chances are it's much better to respond in a calm way. And I've had, when I used to live at the San Francisco Zen Center in a neighborhood up there where there was a lot of crime. A lot of people, a lot of friends I had there were held up at knife point, at gunpoint. And I can go through a whole long list of stories of my friends in a dangerous neighborhood. And my friends who stayed calm through it, it always worked out well. And those who didn't stay calm, it didn't work out well for them. The calmest one that I heard a story was with the guy was being held up at knife point and on the street corner. And then another friend walked by. And just walked by. And so later, the friend who was being held up said, "Oh, you passed me in the street back there. I was talking to that guy. He was robbing me." "Oh, but you guys were just having a calm conversation." "Well, yeah. What happened was that he wanted my wallet, and I explained to him that he was more than welcome to my money, but that I kind of needed my driver's license and my cards, and could we make an arrangement here?" Which he was obliging to do. And so we had this little discussion and we took care of this business and he took my money. So I thought, I'd like that story. It could have been a lot worse. So the suggestion here today is that meditation is a laboratory where we learn about our reactivity, ourselves, and we learn a different way of being with challenges. And that different way of being is one of equanimity, or a balance, or non-reactivity, if you prefer it that way. At some point, the non-reactivity is so well developed, equanimity is so well developed, that the mind doesn't waver, becomes imperturbable no matter what goes on. Something that's really difficult happens, something that's really beautiful happens, the mind doesn't, there's no waves in the mind. It is what it is. It moves through us. Things happen very fast, very tremendously impermanent. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing that supports us. The mind just stays balanced, just continues practice. Great states of ease and peace happen. And there's no tendency to hold on to it. Just peace, great joy and happiness, just that way. And the advantage with finding that balance, that equanimity, is it allows the mind to drop deeper and deeper and deeper, to let go more and more deeply into some of the deepest reservoirs or wellsprings of wisdom, of compassion, of love, of liberation that is possible for human being. And when the mind is being reactive and wanting and not wanting for and against things, the mind can actually not settle to the full potential of peace or well-being, of freedom and of love that's possible for human being. So it's really a wonderful process that we have this kind of laboratory of meditation to find it. And what it means, last thing I'll say, is that when it does happen that your meditations are not what you want them to be, whatever that is, that's when your practice begins. Isn't that nice? So when it's happening in a way, when you're more, more uncomfortable or in some way, say, then you tell yourself, great. Now I have something to work with. Let me look at this more carefully. This is a time, perhaps, where I can explore the whole territory of reactivity and equanimity, reactivity and non-reactivity. And it might not look pretty, it might not create pleasant meditation, but it might give you a lot of understanding about yourself and a lot of strength as you hold your ground, as you stay patient, don't give in, as you let go, that will carry over and be much more useful in daily life than if you'd had a calm meditation practice sitting. So, may you all discover the bliss of equanimity. So now we have our potluck.